hello and welcome to Monocle24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
When there's reliable, dedicated service here in the United States, it's oversubscribed, right? People do not want to be on these roads.
Is it time for a fresh start for mobility in America? With a new administration taking residence at the White House and a new beginning for cities recovering from the pandemic, is there some hope on the horizon for transport in the United States? This week, we look at the potential for a new dawn when it comes to how Americans get around. From railway improvements to the reimagining of aging infrastructure, the future looks brighter after a dim recent history for the transport sector. All that is coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to the programme. Now, we start today by taking a look at a form of transit that doesn't have the best of reputations in the United States. Compared to the likes of Europe and Asia, passenger rail transit in America has never been something that the country has appeared to excel at. While freight rail is a booming industry, getting people from A to B in a train carriage is often comparatively slow, complicated, and expensive. But the new administration might be just the right team to ignite a love affair with the locomotive. To tell us her thoughts, here's Monocle's Carlotta Rabello.
As a producer of Monocle 24's programme about cities, it's been difficult to hide my enthusiasm over what a Biden presidency might mean for one particular issue of national importance, the future of the US rail network. After all, it's no secret how much Biden loves trains, particularly Amtrak, the long-distance U.S. passenger rail operator that has been his trusty companion during his 47-year political career. For decades, Biden commuted by train between his job as a senator in Washington and his home in Wilmington, Delaware, earning him the nickname Amtrak Joe. In 1987, he kicked off his first presidential run at Wilmington's train station. In 2009, he rode Amtrak to Washington, D.C. for Barack Obama's inauguration. He then left the Capitol in a similar fashion after Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017. As a presidential candidate last September, Biden toured Ohio and Pennsylvania on a specially chartered Amtrak train dubbed the Build Back Better Express. Biden's practical support for rail has never waned either. 10 years ago, in an article for Amtrak's onboard magazine, Arrive, he illustrated the importance of investing in rail as a way to connect communities and carry us all into a leaner, cleaner, greener 21st century. On the campaign trail last year, he promised, as president, to spark the second great railroad revolution. His campaign has since unveiled a $1.3 trillion infrastructure plan, promising a safer and faster rail system that is beneficial to all, including in the fight against climate change. Along with most transport providers, Amtrak has been hard hit by the pandemic. But its 2050 vision includes an ambitious expansion plan for new corridors connecting small and mid-sized cities and addressing the decades-old challenge of cross-country travel. For Amtrak to survive, it needs someone at the helm who understands the benefits of rail travel and, dare I suggest, introduces Train Force One to the stable of presidential vehicles. At the same time, having a former mayor serve as the new U.S. Transportation Secretary should bring some hope to those who have long despaired at the country's state of mobility. Mayors know how to keep things running. They have little choice. Our cities are constantly moving, and urban dwellers are more than happy to hold officials accountable when things don't go the right way in their neighborhoods. Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and the first openly gay cabinet secretary, has long been an advocate of upgrading America's creaky transit infrastructure. During the Democratic primaries, running against his now boss, President Biden, he proposed a $1 trillion infrastructure plan that included $150 billion for the Federal Transit Administration to invest in public transit. He also pledged to repair at least 50% of the country's bridges and roads in the next decade, and was the only candidate to commit to ending traffic deaths. During his confirmation hearings in the Senate, he doubled down on the need to shift cities away from an auto-centric approach to street design and gave a shout-out to trains, noting wryly that he's probably the second biggest passenger rail enthusiast in this administration, of course, after Biden. A mayor solves problems, so having someone with that experience at the helm of the U.S. Transportation Agency has potential. Buttigieg also benefits from his age. At 39, one can only hope he'll bring new ideas and a fresh vision to a department in serious need of an overhaul. The proof will be in his actions, but for urban aficionados like myself, the question is, is there a better pairing than Mayor Pete and Amtrak Joe to put mobility on the right track?
The urbanist Carlotta Rabello there. Well, to discuss the seemingly positive future for US Rail, I'm now joined by Nicole Bruin, who's the Senior Vice President of Government and Public Affairs at the Railway Supply Institute, a trade association that acts on behalf of its members to support, connect, and advocate for railway suppliers. Okay, Nicole, we know that rail freight has remained important in America, but the story of passenger rail has always seemed a bit more complex. There are lots of different suppliers. Americans seem to have more of a willingness to use air travel to get between cities. Perhaps there's even a bit of neglect around investment in passenger rail. Tell me, what is the state of play in the country?
Well, I think we have to do a little bit of a history lesson when we look at rail in the United States. So freight rail here in the U.S. is all privately owned. That occurred around 1980 when the U.S. government deregulated freight railroads. And that really allowed the railroads to really start reinvesting their capital back into their lines. And the North American freight system is, you know, it's in a class of its own. We just recently did have a report card, a separate association of civil engineers just did a report card of infrastructure here in the United States. And the freight railroads were given a B, which is a very solid grade, right? So that means essentially that the freight side of American railroading is very solid, very strong, publicly traded. You know, this is actually what we consider the good sense of our overall economy. So people look to the freight railroading industry here in the U.S. to see how we're doing as a nation. Now, railroading here in the United States on the passenger front, you can think of it almost divided into two categories. You could think of it from an inner city passenger rail perspective. When we say that, we're really referring to Amtrak. They are the main operator here in the U.S. in the Northeast Corridor. That's essentially Washington, D.C., running up the East Coast up to Boston. So you hit major cities, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. That's a major corridor. North of D.C., Amtrak owns that right of way. And so it makes it very easy for them, or easier, I should say, to make investments, earn the rate of return on the systems, and really invest back into that corridor. Elsewhere, they essentially are running over those private tracks that I mentioned. They have arrangements that are blessed by the railroads and then the U.S. government that helps, you know, mediate those agreements to allow Amtrak to run over those tracks. So we have long distance trains and then regional trains or state supported trains. So the way that Amtrak is currently structured, unfortunately, you have regions that are more invested than others. So that Northeast Corridor I mentioned, heavily invested. Chicago to St. Louis, good investment. California and the high-speed rail project that's operating on the West Coast, a lot of attention and money is poured into that. The long-distance trains between, say, Chicago in California, Chicago and Texas, they're funded and people ride those trains. It's just, unfortunately, it's a little bit of a struggle because those are federal dollars that go into those trains. And, you know, Congress doesn't always see the necessity to continue funding long-distance trains where you have service that, you know, sometimes you have a train that stops in your town at 2 a.m. And there's a question to what is that? Why do we have to do that? And so there's a question out there as to whether or not we can do away with the long distance trains and really think about more regional service instead of along point B to point C, because what happens in between is that freight rails also have to go over the same tracks. There's not a dedicated corridor and you do have delays.
What's interesting is, you know, we have a new administration in Washington, D.C., and I see that your organization did put out a congratulatory message to the new Secretary for Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, Do you think that he's going to be good news for rail in America?
I do, especially on the passenger front. You know, the Biden administration, we lovingly refer to him as Amtrak Joe, because when he was in the U.S. Senate, you know, he rode Amtrak almost daily back and forth from Delaware. And he's always been a huge champion of passenger rail and transit. So I know that Secretary Buttigieg will continue to have that same viewpoint. And the deputy secretary of the U.S. DOT is Polly Trottenberg. She's the secretary's right-hand gal, so to speak, and she's so smart on policy when it comes to both rail on the freight side as well as the passenger side that she's going to be such a welcome addition to the policy team over at DOT. So I really think that they're kind of like this power couple. I really do. I mean, the secretary has the national profile. You know, he was a candidate for president and he, you know, did very well in the primary. So he's got that national name recognition. He's kind of making rail sexy again, so to speak. And with Polly and her just experience coming from the Hill, working in New York City for the many years that she did running their Department of Transportation, you know, she's just got the policy chops and the not only the national ability, she's also got that ability to kind of see the forest through the trees, and she really understands the players. So we're very excited about the possibility of this administration. The problem is, as with everything else, and I think you can appreciate this in the UK, it kind of comes down to the politics, right? It's going to come down to how you're going to pay for these programs that are really going to help elevate the future of rail passenger transportation here in the United States.
But now you have an administration that believes that climate change is a real thing, and every nation is looking at how rail can help them in that situation. Does that also give an additional kind of focus on your work?
Absolutely. You know, coming from where I sit, we are in the business of trying to help solve the sustainability and the climate questions. You know, a lot of our members have been doing this on a global scale. This is not their first rodeo, so to speak. This has been out there. This technology is out there. They're working in the private sector as well as with government to try to elevate where we are with locomotive technology, whether it's through hybrid technology, battery powered, hydrogen. I mean, that is very much at the forefront. Electrification has been discussed quite a bit here in the United States and how we can increase the electrification in certain corridors where it makes sense. So, you know, we're very excited about working with our government and with our customers to try to help achieve these climate goals. And I understanding that this administration, this Congress, we've kind of got this one bite at the apple over the next 2 years to really try to push through some initiatives that can really lend itself to the overall global climate challenge that we're all facing. And the Biden administration is starting to shop this idea. They're actually calling it, well, I don't know if they're calling it stimulus too, but you know, we just passed a very large COVID recovery bill, $1.9 trillion that included money to help Amtrak and commuter railroads here in the United States get them through operating challenges and capital challenges that they've been struck with due to COVID. So there was money in there. And this is, I think, the third package, right? That was the third package we've passed since last March of 2020 to kind of help the American individual as well as small businesses and our public entities really kind of weather the storm, so to speak, so that we'll be able to come through it better situated. So it's an investment in our future. And so the Biden administration has come out with, they're floating this idea of a $3 trillion infrastructure package, possibly splitting it, one being infrastructure, everything that you think could go into infrastructure, and the second really looking at things like education and funding for schools here in the United States. And so what I've heard it referred to is Stimulus 2. Which, you know, I don't think anyone really likes calling it stimulus. I think that makes it more challenging on the political front to talk about things as a stimulus rather than an investment in a way to make sure that we have well-paying jobs that people are able to, you know, pay their rent, pay their mortgage, send their kids to school, pay for their health care. And, you know, we look at that as an important feature because, you know, we are all about, from the Railway Supply Institute point of view, you know, we're very much about jobs in domestic manufacturing here in the United States. So where we can play a role in helping, you know, meet our climate goals, meet our infrastructure challenges, work with our customers to get them there, like that is our mission, right?
Nicole Bruin, Senior Vice President of Government and Public Affairs at the Railway Supply Institute there. And thank you for joining us. Up next, we head to the West Coast. Stay with us. San Francisco has always prided itself on its countercultural attitude. Even in a country where the car is king, its public transport woes are unique. The nearly 8 million people in the Bay Area, spread across San Francisco, Redwood City, Oakland, Berkeley, San Jose, Silicon Valley, and the surrounding counties, are served by more than 24 largely disconnected transit agencies. That is, until the Transbay Transit Center, replete with a grand public park on its rooftop, opened in late 2019. When it's eventually running at full capacity, this five-level structure will be the meeting point of all the local, regional, and statewide transit. Monocle's Nick Manise caught up with Peter Albert, the former director of planning at the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Peter started by telling us why the project is so significant.
The Transbay Terminal is hugely important because it's this idea of being able to arrive in San Francisco with extreme facility, comfort, immediacy from anywhere in the Bay Area and being at the heart of the very city. I would say that San Francisco is generally seen as a very transit-rich city, and it's got a great mode split, almost in spite of itself. It has people that really want to ride transit, but the hardship, I would think you would hear from people in the Bay Area, and this isn't really something that transfers well to very many cities outside the Bay Area. People would say we have too many transit districts that are all unconnected as they reach downtown San Francisco. So one of the biggest challenges isn't that people don't have a service, it's that the services are disconnected. If you were living in Oakland and working in Redwood City on the peninsula near the airport, you have a real tough slog because there's not one line that will take you from Oakland to Redwood City. You have to transfer through San Francisco. And that transfer is not one service on top of another, it's three or four different connections. So what does the Transbay Terminal represent? It represents the physical culmination of design unification, that seamlessness is actually embodied in one single facility. If you think that for the first time, you can go from the East Bay to San Francisco to the peninsula in one transit trip, and that's by the grace of the Transbay Terminal, then you're understanding the importance of that facility in the region, not just San Francisco.
Is there something to be said about the building, you know, regardless of the rooftop park? The building's still about serving people, about connecting people, about public transit. How do you see those criticisms being responded to by the actual function of the building?
You know, one of the criticisms you might hear about it is, great, we built a really fancy bus terminal because the only clients using the terminal right now are bus riders. And they're important. And that's actually a good economic justice question. If you look at the demographics of people riding the trains versus people riding the buses skew much more low income. The buses that fill up in the morning coming in from Oakland are often filled with the people who can't really afford to ride BART every day. They're making the choice to ride the bus because it's cheaper. So it's actually worthy of celebrating bus riders. They're a huge part of the transit community. The experience should be better. They shouldn't have to get off in some dismal location on the outskirts of town and then make two or three transfer trips in. So the Transbay Terminal is a beautiful place to land, and it did actually result in an uptick in bus ridership because it became more convenient and because the experience actually was raised in stature. There was something symbolic about coming into a beautiful new facility that clearly had a lot of design considerations and access to amenities, that you could go up to the garden and get a coffee. You could listen to music before your bus came. You could take a walk after work, and you're eight stories up, and you have an extraordinary view of downtown. And it's not just the domain of the luxury people in the high-rise buildings. It's also the bus riders who are just a few steps away from all this. And I started to see that. I started to see people arriving early for their bus ride home, letting a bus slip because they're enjoying themselves in the garden, which means they're staying and enjoying the city that much longer.
We sort of talked about this off air, but you're talking about the number of people sort of using this transit center. It is kind of like a grand central station of the West almost, but with an amazing park. And, you know, a whole new neighborhood is emerging around the transit center with affordable housing in there too, you know, and it's all being built on this currently vacant land surrounding it. Maybe a nice way of wrapping this up is starting to look at why having this public space and this park directly linked to a huge transit connection that's surrounded by new housing is so important for San Francisco.
What's unusual about the Transbay Terminal is it has multiple dynamic functions always happening at the same time. So if it were just a transit facility in the middle of nowhere, then maybe there wouldn't be a need for open space. But if it's also the front yard of thousands of new residents of all scales of economic stratification, right? There's this whole level of people who are working in the buildings, and basically they live there during the day and they have their needs. They may be janitors coming in the morning. They may be office workers. They may be executives. So the open space has value, not just as a breathing room for people who take the trains and have a few minutes to kill, or a destination in and of itself for people who want to see the city from a new perspective. But if we had no train and bus facility there, would we still need all that acreage of open space for that high density population of workers and residents? The answer would be yeah. And interestingly, it's one of those rare open spaces that is not dead after 5 o'clock at night, because a lot of the people are coming home at that time. There's no example I can think of in America quite like this. This experiment that this is always going to be activated by somebody. There's always the ability that someone's going to throw open a curtain and look out on that open space, even at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Peter Albert there, in conversation with Monocle's Nick Manise. Staying in California now, and we're heading to Los Angeles to look at how to upcycle a classic roadside feature that is especially abundant in this West Coast city. Part of what needs to be considered when talking about all of the new improvements and development in transport is what will happen to those parts of our built environment that will be left behind by innovations and new developments. It's a sad fact that more Angelenos live closer to one of the city's gas stations than they do to a public park. Often sitting on some of the most prime real estate in sight, these pit stops will become less and less essential as Los Angeles gears up to go 100% electric by 2050. So, what do we do with LA's gas stations? The city recently challenged a group of architects to put forward proposals for specific sites in LA in the Pump to Plug initiative, specifically looking for ideas on how the sites can benefit the local communities. We spoke with Jan Krimsky, the design director of Perkins and Will Los Angeles. They're one of the design firms who took up the task to reimagine these spaces. Let's have a listen to what they found.
The Trust for Public Land ranks Los Angeles 49th among all cities in the United States for access to green space. We're just below Las Vegas, I think, in the rankings. All the other major cities in the United States rank among the top 10, places like Chicago, San Francisco, New York, really all the major cities in the United States. And so it's really a major difference between the kind of environment that we have here in Los Angeles and these other places. So in California, we have our own emissions laws. They are more stringent than the rest of the United States. And what Governor Newsom has done is accelerate our process for essentially getting to zero emissions. And he's made a mandate that by 2035, we'll have zero emissions vehicles only. So what that does is it prompts the question, what do we do with all of the gas stations that we currently have? And it's a question that many cities are grappling with now as the need for gas starts to decline. So here in Los Angeles, we have a kind of a unique position in the mayor's office, and that is a chief design officer. And our chief design officer is Christopher Hawthorne. And what Christopher Hawthorne did is he took this opportunity to create a symposium around the subject of what we do with gas stations in Los Angeles now that the situation's changing. So he asked a number of architectural firms, design firms, urban thinkers, and planners to come together and basically do presentations around electrified charging stations, around what we do with gas stations, and the third topic was around long-haul trucking. So what we talked about in our presentation was specifically what happens with gas stations in Los Angeles. I would say that for us, the real major epiphany here was that we haven't really taken a chance to think about the future and imagine the future of our cities in too long. And when that's being done, it's being done by commercial interests. So what we really tried to do, at least for the second part of our presentation, was try to open up the thinking and really come up with a number of different ideas. It wasn't about coming up with the perfect solution, but it was about getting people to ask, what if? If instead of the gas station, there was a small park, if there was an orange grove, if there was a kind of micro mobility station where I can get access to bikes or other types of mobility other than auto-oriented mobility. So it's really something I think that we were just trying to almost have like a mini world fair. In some ways, it was that kind of spirit that we were trying to evoke. It's let's start thinking about all the incredible things that we could do with the landscape of Los Angeles if we didn't have 550 gas stations. Initially, we kind of approached it with this attitude about, let's try to inform policy. We're being asked by the mayor's office to look at what the outcomes might be for these gas stations. So how can we give them the best information to really help inform policy? So what we did actually was, rather than just internally think about it, we invited a number of guests to play a kind of role-playing game. So we had policymakers, we had developers join our team at Perkins & Will, and we kind of looked at different sites and imagined what outcomes would be. We set up a series of rules, and we really had kind of a fun engagement around it. And one of the big questions was remediation. So with gas stations, a lot of times the issue for development is, does the site need remediation? Many times the soil is contaminated, and so that's an extra cost burden. In many sites, those sites go vacant for a number of years and nothing happens to them because there's no feasible financial way to turn them into something else. So what does become to some of these sites? I think there are a number of sites that are in high value real estate areas where they will become developed instantaneously. They'll be prized pieces of real estate on major corners. There are others that will linger. And I think you can see this happening around the world. They're either in a kind of long remediation process, or there isn't a buyer. There isn't someone to develop those properties. So it's a question. In Los Angeles, I think housing could be a potential answer for some of the sites. There were other people in the symposium that spoke about how these gas stations might transition, that you might keep the food market, or the food market might become less of a convenience store and more of something that could really sustain a community in terms of selling healthy produce. So, you know, there's a number of things that might happen. It's hard to predict. It's important to say that when we looked at the outcome of what we saw, it wasn't surprising. It was more of the same. And I think that's actually what inspired the rest of our presentation. It was, we need vision. And that what Christopher Hawthorne's doing by getting people from the design community together, to get people from our academic community together to think about this, is exactly the right thing to do. It's to get people to imagine the future, and not because they're a branding agency and they're being hired by a commercial interest to convince us all of the future. It's because we have a genuine need in our city to imagine what the next version of Los Angeles looks like. I hope that COVID has really opened our minds in Los Angeles in terms of how quickly things can change, how quickly our landscape can change, because it has transformed Los Angeles seemingly overnight. And why couldn't we transform it for the better? I think that there was already a kind of movement in Los Angeles with micromobility, these kind of new electrified last mile options that were happening, where we were becoming more of a pedestrian or more of a commuter city in terms of, you know, less time people spending in cars. And also our transit system is improving. Our metro system is constantly improving, adding new lines. And so that's been very incremental over the years. But the thing about Los Angeles is it's so rooted in the automobile. We're a young city and we kind of grew up in the time of the auto industry. And so I think more than any other city, the fingerprint of the auto industry has left its mark here in Los Angeles, which means that we have more work to do. And I think we have more room to imagine what some of these possibilities could be.
Jan Krimsky, Design Director of Perkins & Will Los Angeles there. Thank you for joining us. Well, that's all we have for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlos Rabello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. Now, to play you out of this week's episode, here's Little Eva with the 1962 classic, The Locomotion. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Everybody's